Accession number 29424, reel number 1.
Form a striker. Reel 1. Paul, it's a long time since we met and time to continue our interview. And I wondered if you could tell me more about your work with Amnesty.
Amnesty began in 1961 when I was really in my first major job after being trained as a priest and being a young curate. I was at the BBC in religious broadcasting. And so, of course, the things that really deeply moved me, the things about peace and human rights, were obviously the things I wanted to use in my broadcasts. I had the privilege of producing a program every Sunday night called The Way of Life, a 45-minute feature program. There are no producers in the BBC Radio 4 today who have that kind of luxury. So I could produce anything I wanted, really, that was socially relevant. And when I heard about Peter Benenson and this little group of people who were pleading for amnesty for political prisoners, I pretty well immediately joined them, and with the thought, of course, I can put this on the air. This is a story that ought to be told. And so one of my first feature programs was the early story of Amnesty International, how Peter Benenson, this Catholic lawyer, who was so shocked that the defeat of fascism in the Second World War did not put an end, as many people had hoped, to the persecution of people around the world. And so he researched and produced a little book called Persecution 61, Penguin paperback. He told the story of, if I'm not mistaken, it was 11 political prisoners. They soon came to be called prisoners of conscience, a new term. In 11 different countries, one in each country, right-wing dictatorships and left-wing dictatorships in African countries, which were neither. So you quickly got the world divided into three parts, the communist world and the anti-communist world, and the third world, which was a bit different to either of these. And prisoners, of course, existed in all of them. And I was privileged to put that on the air, which began my amnesty career, as it were. I can't remember exactly when I joined the British Executive Committee for Amnesty of the British section, but it must have been a good few years later, because to start with, Amnesty didn't have national sections. It took a little while for that to happen. But when it did, I was involved more or less from the start in British Amnesty, the British section of it. And by the mid-70s, I was elected chairman of the British section, something I did till 1979. And of course, that involved me with the drudgery, if you like, of chairing a committee, which I'm not good at. I'm not a good bureaucrat at all. I always felt this was the side of me that I liked least, and sometimes other people appreciated least too. They thought I could do it a lot better than that. But anyway, I chaired the British committee, and the really interesting and important things were, of course, of quite a different nature, was getting involved with the release of political prisoners in different countries. I went, for example, to Tanzania, not one of the countries where people think, first of all, of persecution. It was not a particularly bad case of persecution, but Tanzania did have about 50 prisoners who'd never been tried. They'd all committed economic crimes, according to the Tanzanian government, but they had no system of law that could deal with them. And so part of my job was to encourage them to set up proper legislation and proper courts, so that people could be decently tried, because none of these people had provenly done anything. And I found a great deal of cooperation from the Tanzanian government, They were not resentful of my saying these people should not be in prison. They said, we know they shouldn't be in prison, but there's nothing we can do about it because we haven't got the kind of laws that should be dealing with them.
This would have been the Tanzania of Nyerere.
This would be the late area. Yes, it was very much the Tanzania of Julius Nyerere. It was a relatively good and relatively well-governed African country. But then, of course, inevitably, I was involved in the area that, for other reasons, I knew best, and that is the communist countries of Eastern Europe. And indeed, I went on one of the very first missions of Amnesty to East Germany to plead for the release of one of Ulbricht was the head of state in East Germany, one of Ulbricht's star prisoners, leading communist who was disillusioned by the East German system and went west. And of course that was regarded as treason, and the communists kidnapped him in West Berlin and brought him back to East Germany and sent him to prison for 15 years in a secret trial, and he was held in incommunicado. In fact, they didn't even announce his arrest or anything.
Who was that boy?
That was Heinz Brandt, B-R-A-N-D-T. And the Brandt case became very famous. I mean, Bertrand Russell got involved by saying, I will send back to these Germans my Ossietzky medal that they awarded me if this man is not released. And, you know, a great deal of pressure was brought on the East German government. And in the end, I went disguised as a peace delegation, led not by me, but by Canon John Collins. I did the talking. He did the representation because he was acceptable to the East German regime as the chairman of CND. And so we came as a peace delegation, but with the intent of meeting Ulbricht personally and pleading for this man's release. And it almost came apart. We were subject to the whole propaganda machine of the East German system, showing us around East Berlin with television cameras and everything. They used our presence to... And we had to put up with this, knowing that if we didn't put up with it, we wouldn't be able to help this guy. So, at the end, they took us to see the Berlin Wall from the other side, and at the Brandenburg Gate introduced us to the commanding general of the frontier defences of the GDR, as he was called, and he produced a great visitor's book for us to sign as having inspected the wall. The wall was called the Defensive Wall Against Fascism, and we looked at each other, John Collins and I, and said, there is a limit to what we will do. To sign this book, therefore, as it were, validating the Berlin Wall, is something that was beyond our limit. So we shook our heads and said, sorry, we won't. And we thought, well, we've blown it. Probably Ulbricht won't meet us now. But he did, in spite of that. And... we had what amounted to a 2.5-hour tough meeting with him and his top people. He wasn't alone. We were all sitting round a large table, ostensibly drinking coffee together. But he did all the talking. His minister of propaganda was sitting beside him. His deputy foreign minister was sitting beside him. He had a whole panoply of top people. Not one of them said a syllable through the whole 2.5 hours. So here were us debating with Walter Ulbricht. And
what was your impression of him? Had you met him before?
I never met him before. Not before, not again after. I'd been led to believe the worst of him. I'd been led to believe that he was a peasant of no intelligence, of a certain degree of cunning, but that's it. Well, the reality was much more sophisticated than that. His German was abysmal. Well, shall we say it was working class Glaswegian, working class Leipzig, and that's pretty hard to understand for somebody who's, you know, like working class Glaswegian. So once you forgot his lingo, he talked a lot of sense, and he was very friendly. He was open, but he was determined to talk about his own concerns and not ours. He wanted to defend the Berlin Wall, and he defended it very cleverly. I've written about this in various places, but he quite brilliantly said, well, this wall is there to protect world peace. I hate it, and it makes me a hated person, because to lock my own people up is pretty awful. But I have no choice. The truth is, most of them don't believe in socialism. They haven't been properly educated. They want to go to the rich West. The only thing I can do is stop them, or this little state of ours would collapse. One day they will learn. In the meantime, I've got to lock them up. I have no choice. And when we went on to challenge him and said, but do you really need to shoot people trying to get across that wall? He said, well, every shot against a person on that trying to cross that wall is a shot against me. Because what better propaganda could I give the West than shooting people coming across that wall? What better propaganda do I give my enemies? But I have no choice. If people knew they could get across without being stopped forcibly, I might as well not have built it. An incredible sort of, you know, astonishing honesty, exactly this, describing the situation as it actually was. And he said, who knows what the Russians would do? He referred to the Russians always, them back there. Who knows what they back there would do if my little German communist state collapsed? We might have a world war on our hands. It was a very hard position to oppose.
Very disarming.
Very disarming. He was disarming, he was clever, but he knew that this was an off-the-record conversation and that we'd blow it if we reported it. We'd promised not to report the conversation. We hadn't officially met him at all. And or if we had met him, he was meeting a peace delegation, and the kind of things he said would never appear in the East German press, of course. I mean, they were what he really knew to be true, but his press said the opposite. And
how did you deal with that?
So it was, well, we just listened to it. But, you know, at some stage, and he was still in full flow defending his position, we stopped him and said, Mr. Ulrich, you know that the real reason we're here is not to discuss politics, but to discuss the release of a prisoner you should not be holding, a man who has committed no crime except to disagree with your regime. That's the only crime he's committed, and that is not a crime in any serious sense of the word. We think you're doing yourself a disservice by holding him, and you're certainly doing something very cruel to a very decent socialist, who remains a very decent socialist, even though his version of socialism is no longer yours. And he then got very angry. The nice Ulbricht, who was happy talking politics, was the nasty Ulbricht, who hated talking about this sort of thing. He began to attack us. He said, why do you ruin the chances of peace by raising such a contentious issue? We thought you were peace-loving people. This is something that is our business. We regard him as a traitor, and it's none of your business. He got quite aggressive and said to us, you're wasting your time appealing for him. He's been quite correctly tried and sentenced, and that's it. To which we said, that's not it. We believe that is wrong and that should be revised. And here we've brought with us a whole dossier telling you why. Will you please give this to your Ministry of Justice and tell them to take up this case again and revise it? Well, he was in a corner, and all he could do was say, I will hand this. He did say, I will hand this to the Ministry of Justice, but I can assure you it will have no effect, because I know we have done the right thing. But at least we had got that far. And in fact, a man sentenced to 15 years was released after 3. But it took that sort of pressure. And of course, it wasn't just our visit. It was a whole lot of different pressures brought on the East German system. But this is one example of how, you know, behind the scenes, you work for somebody. I never forget the parting lines. We had already, by this time, in a rather more frosty way, made our farewells and thanked him for the coffee and talking to us at all. When he called us back, we were walking towards the door, and he sort of shouted to us, and he said, I can't understand you. This man claims still to be a communist. I think he's a traitor to communism, but he claims he's still a communist. He's certainly no Christian. What's he got to do with you? And, you know, two parsons. What's he got to do with you? And I remember, I think John Collins, I can't remember now whether it was John Collins or me, who simply turned around and said, Herr Ulbricht, he is a human being. That's all that matters. And there it ended. But it's a good example of the kind of work you can do for Amnesty, and of course missions of knowledgeable people, lawyers and others, going to talk behind the scenes to governments has always been one of Amnesty's tasks, the least publicised part of it all. But I suppose my main contribution over the years as chairman was my gifts of communication. It wasn't just that first programme I put on the air in the very early stages, but I was on the air on what today called the Today programme or similar programmes of radio and television constantly.
I do remember.
And it was really being the public face of Amnesty in Britain for a few years.
What sort of response were you getting, you know, from those early days with your programme and then these appearances? Were you, you know, was Amnesty recruiting?
Amnesty was gradually building up its membership and the public understanding of what it was all about. I think at the beginning, because, you know, Britain's a relatively conservative society, a lot of people thought, oh, well, when people get locked up, they must have done something wrong. You know, and these Amnesty people are really supporting terrorists, or, you know, the penny didn't drop that Amnesty never appealed for people who'd used violence. So it took a long time for people to realise that we were really simply concerned with people locked up simply because of their race or their religion or their political beliefs, but people who'd been peaceful and not violent. You know, the message took a long time. But I think over those years when I was chairman, which is 75 to 79, were years when Amnesty sort of broke through that barrier and became a mass organisation with branches all over the country, with school groups, with university groups, with individual realising we can do something about it. This has been the whole philosophy of Amnesty. It's not about people up there doing it. It's ordinary people at a local level writing postcards, writing letters. The penny dropped. And so I would say among the liberal minority, if you like, of the British population, but that's a large minority, amnesty became a household word, and people were quite proud to be part of it. And one of the signs of that is, of course, that by the time I left being chairman, Amnesty no longer had financial problems. And I don't think it's had financial problems ever since. In other words, the large membership and the efforts of local people to raise money for Amnesty, the necessary money to run what became a bigger and bigger organisation, that worked very well. So, and Amnesty's skills in money raising were great, but people responded. Once you explain to people why you need the money, it comes in. So Amnesty is one of the organisations, one of the perhaps relatively few, that keeps on appealing, but successfully. You know, it's never had to cut back. On the contrary, ever since, it has grown more and more and more.
It does also, am I right in thinking, it's always striven to give evidence of what it's doing. And, you know, you get information about the success, say, in getting prisoners released.
Yeah, of course. Amnesty's attempt to be transparent to people, to make clear what we're doing, not making false claims of greater success than we have, but, of course, constantly being able to produce people from around the world who have been released as a result of Amnesty. And I think that's very important. People can tell their own stories. If it wasn't for Amnesty, I'd still be in prison. There were many such stories. In the early years, we used to have a symbolic prisoner of the year who would come and light a candle in St. Paul's Cathedral or some symbolic act like that. That was dropped after a while because there were too many, and why select one out of the many? But that was part of the build-up to create a few symbolic figures. And in fact, Heinz Brandt, when he was released, was the prisoner of the year. I think it must have been in 1965 or 66, about when he was released. I don't remember the exact year, but I've got a picture of him lighting a candle in St. Paul's Cathedral.
And the logo is very striking, isn't it?
The candle with barbed wire around it, yes. My most remarkable story, by far, is when I went to Russia for the funeral of the Archbishop of Leningrad. That story is worth telling quite separately for other reasons. It was a very significant visit to Russia. If my memory does not deceive me, it must have been about 1979. I'm not quite sure of the year. It could be easily researched because it's the year that Archbishop Nikodim died in the presence of Pope John Paul I, who was Pope for only 6 weeks before he died. Well, Archbishop Nikodim came to see the Pope as a representative of the Russian Orthodox Church, and had a heart attack in his presence and died. And the Pope died a few weeks later. and of course his body was brought back to Leningrad, and there was a great international funeral. And Bishop Runcie, who later became Archbishop of Canterbury, was the official representative of the Church of England. And he took me with him to hold his hand and guide him through the difficulties of Russia, because I had a little more experience of that than he did. But the relevance of this to Amnesty is quite extraordinary, because we were given a guide, as every visitor to Soviet Russia was given. And the guide was, of course, somebody who had to report on you to the Soviet secret services. His job was to keep an eye on you as well as to guide you, and to make sure you went where you were required to go and nowhere else. And whatever you did or said was then reported to the requisite people. So we too were given a guide. That's exactly what we expected. But he was rather different. He wasn't one of the professional guides who are usually also professional interpreters, because death comes unexpectedly, and all the sort of official people had already been planned for other work. So they had to fish around and find some special people who don't normally do such things. And they found a youngish man in his late 30s or early 40s who spoke tolerable English, but not very good. But it was enough to get us around and help us linguistically. And he didn't explain to us why he'd been given this job, other than to say, this is the first time in my life I've had the privilege of accompanying Western visitors. That's really all we knew about him, except that at some earlier stage in his life he'd studied English. Well, when we went to the airport to leave Russia after this funeral, the bishop went on one plane, and I went on a plane going via Berlin, where I was stopping off, 2 hours later. So I had 2 hours to spare after saying farewell to Bishop Runcie, who flew straight back to London. And Ivan, which was our guide's name, Ivan said to me, "Would you be kind enough to buy me a meal in the international restaurant?" And you must know that a Soviet airport at that time had two restaurants: a local restaurant where you paid for the meal in Russian money, an international restaurant where you paid for the meal in hard currency from the West. And the quality of the food differed considerably from the one to the other. So, of course, I thought he was just really trying to get a decent meal before I left. And I said, "Of course I'll buy you a meal in the international restaurant." And when we got into the restaurant, we found it was virtually empty. But even then he went to the furthest away corner, as far from anybody else as one could go, and sat down and said to me, "It's not about the food, it's because I need to talk to you." And I said, "Well, Ivan, what do you want?" Ivan said, "I've got to write a report for our secret services about you, and I have never done such a thing in my life before. What shall I say? You haven't done anything very interesting, or said anything very interesting, other than what I would expect." And I said to him, "Well, Ivan, I've never been asked such a strange question. I must say I'm slightly suspicious whether you're the Secret Service asking me to write the report itself. But here goes." I said, "I can't really help you. You can't invent things I did. Just say I didn't do anything special. But what did they say to you about the bishop and me?" And he said, "Well, they said to me, the bishop was just an ordinary sort of bishop, and I needn't worry too much about him. But they said you were a very dangerous person, and I had to keep a very close eye on you." And I said, "Well, Ivan, let me tell you why they thought I was such a dangerous person.